Kia ora koutou, welcome to the DAS. It's really great that you've come along on such a beautiful day out here, so thank you for taking the time to come into a dark space on what is one of a few lovely days in Huntington. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Melanie Oliver, the curator here. And it's a real pleasure to have Richard Prater to talk about his work for us today. Richard's normally based in Berlin, but has been here for a couple of months, so it's a real treat to have him here to come be in the show and make the work, as well as to talk to it today. And we've got our strategy for today is to be fast and furious.
Yeah.
3 works in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So we'll get a little bit of an introduction to a couple of other works that Richard has made. One here in Wellington at the Animal Gallery, with Stephen Penland, who's here. And then another, and then we'll follow up by talking about Stop Show, the West version that we have sitting right here. So sorry about the extra noise levels, hopefully we can just listen in. But if you'd join me in welcoming Richard.
Thank you. I want to just say thank you to Melanie and for inviting me to be a part of this project, a show that I find to be really important. So thank you, Melanie. And I also would like to thank Noo, who's not actually present, because he's been very helpful over the course of my install, and Gerda, who's one of the key install people, who also can't be with us today. And thank you all for coming along and being present. Yeah, I really appreciate it. I'm going to start today by introducing a project that I did in 2015 at the Adam Gallery. It was quite a dense project, and I would call it a research project, and I still don't know how to frame it, whether it's an experimental film or like an experimental sculptural project, but what it centered around was my relationship with the Kakapo. Over the course of about 5 years. So every time I came back to Wellington, I would go and visit this lady called Moggy, who's a bird enthusiast, and she invites the kakas into her garden and feeds them. Over about 10 years, she's been working quite closely with Zealandia, the bird sanctuary, to record which of the birds are coming and visiting her from the sanctuary, and which of the birds that are living and breeding in the suburbs were visiting her house. And so my project was essentially a project about urban ecology, and I found that to be like a really important central point to the project, this kind of returning to this particular location. And over the course of 5 years, what I would learn was that the research that was happening around the kaka was changing. And their dietary, they have a very fragile diet, very precarious diet, and they are obviously susceptible to a lot more dangers in the urban environment. One of the primary being lead poisoning that occurs when they chew on lead roofing nails and lead gutters and lead paint on all of the suburbs, suburban houses around the sanctuary, outside the sanctuary. What I did is I would like meet with researchers, a biologist called Aditi Shireen, I hope I got her name right, who has a really important research project about how the lead was affecting the kakas, and also whether there was some kind of affinity between calcium and lead, because the baby chicks that were being born in the suburbs were coming up with lead poisoning, and that was really bad. So that was one of the persons I met, and then also I met I met Matu, who's at the sanctuary, and he, of course, cautioned me to how nuts, like certain people would be feeding them nuts, and if if they were overexposed to a certain nut, like a Brazil nut or a man, or an almond nut, they would actually get poisoning and their bones would become brittle. And so it seemed like there was this kind of this problem where we were kind of killing them with our kindness, you know. And that became like quite interesting for me, like as a problem. The project started actually in 2011 when I was invited to the Adam Art Gallery to do some research on Wellington as a city, and I had no idea what to do. And I ended up doing something incredibly indulgent. I brought a whole heap of 16mm film, because I'd never made a 16mm film before. And I went around the city with my 16mm camera and collected all of this footage, which I thought was, I have no idea what to do with. But basically what I was looking at were these kind of borders or territories where nature, as we kind of narrate it and understand it to be, was meeting suburbia or urbanism or whatever, whatever we use to comparatively to compare to nature. So that's what I did. And when I came back in 2015 to the Adam to do an exhibition, I decided to take that 16mm film and get it processed. And when I got it processed, I also asked to purchase the silver residue that comes out of the film when you process it, and I took that piece of silver, and I just want to quickly show you these markers. Oh, I don't. My computer doesn't let me show you. So anyway, this is the car. Beautiful bird. I took this piece of silver and I sent it to Jens Hansen, who's the official Lord of the Rings maker, and I commissioned him to make a souvenir Lord of the Rings ring out of it. And the reason I did that was because the whole time that I was researching on this project, the whole Lord of the Rings production was happening in Wellington. And I was quite interested in, one problem that I was interested in is that that there's this kind of indifference that happens in a city, that there's this enlivening in the city, and then there's like a multiplicity of behaviours and receptions from different animals and birds and humans that all kind of co-inhabit the city at the same time. And I wanted to essentially affirm, like a kind of, I wanted to kind of, I was aware at the time that there was a lot of artistic and like artists kind of being anti Lord of the Rings because it was somehow it has a cultural monopoly on like artistic or creative production, and I thought that was quite funny. And what I wanted to do was essentially address this kind of terror of cultural monopoly and like make, you know, feed my film into it, like get it kind of erase it, like get it kind of forgotten. And I did that because what I really wanted to do, complex as this, is make an exhibition where I created two experiential spaces, one inside a gallery and one outside in the suburbs, and where I could create some space to have a conversation with the kapa, kaka, and create a space also for other people to have a kind of conversation with the kaka. So every sculpture that I made in this exhibition was a tracing of my kind of personal relationship with the kaka or another researcher's relationship with the kaka. And so, for instance, in this space, which is the Kirk Gallery and the Adam Art Gallery, which is devoted to film projections, and is completely closed down, I decided to cut a window into the wall and allow light to come into that space and penetrate two objects, expose those objects. And one of those objects was a nail gun, which became for me emblematic of the suburban drive, you know, the power of suburbia kind of pushing into the landscape. And I think there is this really powerful image in Wellington of the suburban kind of the suburban drive, like running up the mountains and then the green belt kind of coming down into the suburb, into the housing. So that for me became this emblem. And it's a gun, you know, it's a nail gun, and it's, and somehow it's also this kind of thought, this head or something, that's what I was thinking about. And then on the window I had a mortar and pestle, and inside the mortar and pestle I grinded lead that I'd collected from roofing nails that had been decommissioned out of this. At the moment, this is an ongoing process in Wellington, that there's a decommissioning of lead from suburban houses. They're being replaced with steel, zinc, whatever's less poisonous. And in this space, I repeated the gesture with the nail gun, so I hit that double, and in two of the rooms in a house that Stephen helped me secure, which had about 20, it was like an old student hostel that's part of the Victoria University, was amazing. It was so amazing. We secured this house, or Stephen secured this house, and we occupied two rooms, and I presented a collaborative work with Richard Francis, which was a sound work, and it was he normally works with vinyl records, so we took side A, and we dealt with the bird sanctuary, and I took a recording in there of the carcass at witch hour, when they're doing their little, like, what we call, like, the space invader tune, which they learned up in Hamilton, interestingly enough. One of the zoo guys taught them how to do this wolf whistle, and all of the ones that have bred down in Wellington now know how to do that wolf whistle, which is really cool. I think it's a really nice interaction with humans. And I had, of course, also the roofing nails in this little box, and then the other. I don't have an image of that space, but it was the same thing repeated. And in that space, I had the recording taken from Moggy's house, my bird enthusiast and friend. So that's quite dense. And that's brought us to 5 minutes, which I'm surprised by, because I thought we would have been about to. Now, what I would like to do is give you guys a break and show you not the. Show you a video that one of my students, Zach, has already seen, and I apologize, you have to see it again, by an artist called John Smith, who's an artist I really admire, and I'll talk to you about why I'm showing you this work, but let's have a break now. Thank you. Thanks for that. I can explain why I showed that video, but I'm going to move on for a minute and segue into another project that I made called April, which coincidentally I made around quite a similar time to the Living Cities project. I presented this in Melbourne. At a space called ECCA, well, that's an abbreviation for Contemporary something or other gallery. it's a huge, big, crusty beetle complex, and massive, similar, in a way similar to the Douse, but it's maybe the two-room kind of complex, slightly larger than the Douse space. And the reason I want to show you this work is because the first project that I introduced to you is kind of a research-driven, like, experiential-focused exhibition, and that's really important for me because it's what I want to do is create quite speculative spaces. But at the same time, I also have another kind of thing that I've been developing, which I call, for my own convenience, like, documentary sculpture. And that's when I'm introducing that now because this is going to relate a bit more to my Oyster and work that we'll talk about. And this work I presented a situation that happened in 2014 actually, when Greenpeace were developing their annual Standing Up for the Earth calendar. It came to be that. One of the photographers that was curated into this calendar was Alain Moffat, who was previously one of the French Secret Service agents that was responsible for blowing up the Rainbow Warrior. And he had been curated in through, I guess, a kind of what you call like an era of accountability. So they probably outsource the calendar to another company, and that company would source the photographers. And it was quite an upsetting situation for Greenpeace that this happened, because it had already been printed and it had already gone into distribution when they realised what had happened. You just couldn't make this story up. And it just so happened that my exhibition was happening in April in 2015, and so I decided that I would present a work that was kind of a document of this situation, and I do find it fascinating. I presented it on April, on the month that Alain Moffat falls on the calendar month of April. So, just bring that up to full screen. So what I did is I started searching for his images online, and I found out that he actually is a wildlife photographer. And interestingly, out of the 12 agents that were responsible for blowing up the Rainbow Warrior, he's the second one that's come out who was remorseful about the situation. So he regretted the situation. He felt that the entire intelligence was bad, and he wished that it hadn't happened, basically. So he was one of the first, but he was also one of the two agents that was arrested in New Zealand. But what happened, of course, in the Rainbow Warrior, as we know, in 1985, is that Fernando Pereira, Portuguese photographer that was on board the Rainbow Warrior, was killed, which is quite, which of course is incredibly sad. And I was interested in creating a work that I felt would talk about this kind of like erasure and of identity. And what I was interested in was whether Alam Afar and kind of becoming a wildlife photographer had sort of sort of sublimating, but also kind of like supplanted his role as a Secret Service agent, and actually taken on that whole skill set over into being a wildlife photographer, where of course you have to try and avoid not being seen, and you know, be disguised and shoot, and so all of this kind of metaphoric language became really important to me. So I one thing that he really likes to shoot is a whole heap of wildlife, bird life, in Australia, where I was doing the show. He likes the Laughing Kookaburra, and in these works, with like his own photography with the Laughing Kookaburra, he has the bird perched on his tripod and perched on his camera, and what that enabled me to do was find out what equipment he actually used, and so I purchased the equipment that he used, and I created this sculpture about the work. Unfortunately, I haven't added. Oh, and here you'll see, this is the lens that he used, which is this insane telephoto zoom lens. So that was kind of what, I didn't even feel like I had to show that, because it was in such a cool box that I just like presented the box. And I put the box on these little quail eggs. What I was hoping to get was Laughing Kookaburra eggs, obviously not ones that had little chicks in them, but you know, the broken shells, because in Tasmania the Laughing Kookaburra is not it's considered not a pest, but it's not I don't know what the word is for it, but essentially it's not endangered or protected in the same way that it is on mainland Australia. So that didn't happen, so you know, you do your best and you put quail eggs under the lens instead. This for me was kind of a turning point in my work, and it will enable me to introduce my other work, which is also taking quite a specific advertisement from Shell Petroleum. But how are we going for time? 70 minutes. Before I do that, I would really like to show you guys one other short video that I've also found quite inspiring, and so it's just a couple of minutes long.
So, how can I be like you? How can I make a noise?
People ask me.
So, how can I be like you? How can I make a noise?
Well, the answer is right in front of your eyes. Spotted people. This is by Brad Habibov. You have 2 kilos, 5 kilos, and 10 kilos. What if I can carry? You can carry, you can swim, and die. You can even become stronger just by carrying back home from the supermarket.
What if I bought other stuff?
Don't buy other stuff. I mean, look, it's fucking good at making you sweat. There's something wrong with that. Why would you drink this thing? It makes no sense. Plastic bottles are very bad for the planet. This is not for carrying water. This is an error. Exactly. Dat is een algemene tip, dat ik mee. Zoals de hele van kracht.
So, the reason that I've shown you these two videos is because what I'm interested in is like the seductive patterns of narrative and the persuasion of narrative. And I'm interested in artists, particularly video artists and filmmakers, that take on kind of Carl Theodore Dreyer's maxim, artifice, when artifice strips artifice of artifice. So it's this idea that we expose the structure or we expose how something is constructed by addressing in a kind of almost in a tautological way that structure. And I find this immensely funny, as you know, personally. I find this kind of stuff really funny. I get a lot of enjoyment and pleasure out of this kind of humor. But what I'm more interested in is a certain kind of climax that we've reached in the commercial world, where the advertisement or the company, the brand, ironizes consumer skepticism. It ironizes the hard sell in order to appeal to a consumer skepticism. And I'm interested in that because there's a lot of what I call green screening happening at the moment, and because there's a lot of uncertainty around climate change and environmentalism, I think what that's creating is basically brands and companies are playing with like the card game with open hands, so they're showing us like everything at their disposal. One of the things they want to show us is like their environmental portfolios, and what I'm calling green screening is when similar to greenwashing, it's when a company makes an investment into, like, for example, TNC, the Nature Conservancy, or into like Greenpeace, although that doesn't happen very often because Greenpeace are pretty careful about stuff. But they're like. I feel like it's time to move to this work, actually, because this is what I'm actually wanting to talk about. So I thought what we could do, sorry to cut that, but we'll get back into it, is just like kind of all stand up and around this work. And I'll give a brief introduction of this work, and then if Mel might ask some questions and see how it goes. For this work, what I took was a Facebook post that I saw while I was writing an essay called Brick Spy, and that was all about political representation, brand communication, and in this particular paper, self control the economic cycle and less abilities built up to 20 million support from Alabama. And then the next line in there said, see how self control the economic supports
to kind of foster and
The second time was a complete disaster. My coach was very creative, which got me in a lot of trouble in the this time of year, I've been working with a expert in Germany who is helping me to create how to have the right positions for the voice. What that is, one of the latest additions is this bridge here, which is really helpful. And that's bringing the temperature down, so because daily temperature is quite often too high. And usually, the 19 degrees in the analysis is kind of right. But at another day, this is why that's being told. The level is particularly exposed, specifically exposed between 12 and 16 degrees. So I have it set in the middle of 14, and the tank's actually around 13. And I'm expecting in the order of years up to 13, which is a slightly smaller area for the design, and it's also exposed to what the sessions are at. So yeah, and
thank you.
establishing that here. And my light was his previous job for doing the Nightmare on the Horizon emergencies. He was in charge of the WWE, the Wrestling Federation, so the fake wrestling, which is a huge